what about the enjoyment? What about the relationships you're going to build? What about the experiences that you're going to get and your own development? It's not all about the money.
On this episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast, we are joined by Coach Jason Smith, the Director of Basketball Operations for the Australian Boomers. A former professional player, Smith had a decorated career in the NBL, winning championships with the Sydney Kings and earning league MVP honors in 2005. He represented Australia in multiple Olympic Games and FIBA World Championships, serving as captain and a key leader for the national team. Following his playing career, Smith transitioned into basketball operations, where he now helps guide the strategic and developmental vision of the Boomers. His background includes international playing experience in Italy and Croatia, which shaped his understanding of global basketball cultures. Coach Smith brings a high-level perspective on what it takes to succeed on and off the court. And in this episode, we talk about the coaching styles he experienced internationally that brought the best out of him as a player, his perspective being on the operational side of the game rather than playing, and how Australia works nationally to build their programs and athletes up for success in the future. Please welcome to the podcast, Coach Jason Smith.
Dr. Dish Basketball is revolutionizing basketball training with the number one selling shooting machine in the world. Our innovative systems are the only training solutions that deliver more reps, motivation, and fun, empowering coaches and players to elevate their game faster than ever before. Featuring advanced analytics, immersive game-like features, and an easy-to-use interface, our state-of-the-art shooting machines are the preferred choice for progressive teams worldwide.
What is up, coaches, and welcome back. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Alan Major, Doug Caputo here. Today, we are chopping it up, talk some basketball with not only a current coach, but somebody who has been around the basketball game playing at different levels in different states, I should say more different continents than a lot of people, and definitely has a high wealth of knowledge. We're excited talking with the current director of basketball operations for the Australian men's national team, ladies and gentlemen, Coach Jason Smith. Coach Smith, welcome.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure to be here. And anytime I get a chance to talk about hoops, I'm in. And I got my man Major here as well. So yeah, really keen to get into it.
Yeah, for sure. Excited, man. I've been looking forward to this one, though. And just on general principle, man, great to see you, brother. You're looking out. Look awesome.
Man, I appreciate it. I don't feel it, but I appreciate you saying that, my man. I'm going to get stateside soon. We're going to hang out. We're going to have a beer, and it'd be great to catch up.
Absolutely.
So, of course, I already got a little sneak peek of, and I know before we were on here, Coach Mage over here was showing me the pictures of you guys, the championships that you won, the successful career that you had from playing career. Going off of that from your college, so then you go into the professional side of things, Australia, Italy, Croatia. I know you got to play in different areas and see different sides of the ball, but then also being on the coaching side now, being as the director of basketball operations with the national team. Across your career thus far, or I should say from before in the NBL, and just internationally, you played under a variety of different coaches, right? What were some of the things that you had saw with the coaches that you had worked with? And was there anything that really resonated to you as a player that kind of drew you in more or got you more amped up to play?
Yeah, it goes back to my college days. I never really experienced the professional standard until I went to college and had Mike Dunlap as the senior coach. And he demanded a standard that I hadn't experience and wasn't expecting. So it was a very new experience to me, but I loved it. The discipline required, the character test, it just really made me think differently about basketball. I just played it because I was good at it and I was tall and I was athletic. I didn't really think about it as a career. But then, so he refined my thought processes into understanding that the game could actually provide me with a career path, and which I gladly accepted that challenge and went on with it. So he introduced me to that. And then when I came back to Australia, I played for Brian Gorgian. And I'd say the thing for him and Mike Dunlap that I experienced for me is that I honestly believe that they cared about me, right? I think that they actually loved me. And it wasn't just what I could do on the court for them. It wasn't a transaction. It was relational. And they believed in me, they invested in me, and they wanted the best for me. And I honestly believe that. And they got the best out of me. So with that relationship, I was willing to sacrifice my body, my mind, in order to provide the best I could. To answer your question, it was the relationship. It wasn't the basketball. It was knowing that he actually cared about me. And that made all the difference, because I'd be willing to run through a brick wall for him.
Coach Dunlap loved us so much that our team practiced in the blackout during an earthquake. Our team had an earthquake. It was an earthquake in Southern California. Campus loses power, and he's, screw it, we're practicing anyway, boy. We had to prop the doors open with trash cans, and literally the light in the gym was sunlight.
Yeah, I didn't say he wasn't crazy. I thought he loved me.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, that's yeah. One came with the other though. But
I think too, God, like when you think about it, we used to compete, right? And that's the one thing I loved practice. I loved practicing because I loved competing, and we were fortunate. The teams that I've been on, we had really good players. So you're always competing someone in your position against someone who's really talented. And I had that my whole career. So I loved the competition, and the coaches that I had drove that really drove it to get that on a daily basis so that you could replicate it in games. It wasn't a freak occurrence that you could actually turn it on in games. It was the easy part of the game. I love that about those coaches. They really drove the competitive nature. And when things went, I remember when Gorge, so here's one. When things were going like just okay, like subpar, Gorgia grabbed me, and I was the captain of the team at the time in Sydney. And he'd say to me, "How do you think practice is going? Did you want a border break or whatever?" And I go, "Yeah, okay." And he goes, "What would you rate it out of 10? I'd say, "I don't know, 6 or 7. He goes, "Why? Why is it a 6 or a 7? Why is it my job to deliver an 8 or a 9? Like, you're the captain. What are you going to do about it?" So then this conversation happened 10 seconds on the sideline, and then I'd go back into practice, and then I'd just ramp it up and notch it up and then get either into it with someone or just try to elevate the competitive nature with a couple of dudes, and then practice would be a 9. All right, so I loved that. I really enjoyed it. I took responsibility and accountability to ensure that when we practice and it was a practice day, like we were on, like we wanted to make sure we were competing hard and that we weren't missing out on an opportunity to get better.
Yeah. Love that, man. No, those two guys are big on ownership. Just like you said, man, just they'll get you to the court, but there's an expectation that they both had, that you felt that healthy pressure to be exceptional every day. You could not, if it was comfortable, those guys didn't do comfortable, neither one of them, in a good way.
No,
helped elevate everybody.
And you trusted them, right? Because at the end of the day, like I said, you knew they cared about it. And we were talking the offseason around career path and where we're heading and that type of thing. But I trusted them with my career. I trusted them with what we were doing on a daily basis. And the byproduct is we won, right? So we were really competitive. We were really good. And we won everything. Why wouldn't I trust that? So if you're competitive, you're having fun as well, and you're winning, it's a really good recipe.
The winning can cancel a lot. It definitely can, especially if you're not having the fun part or doing. Yeah. But if you're winning and you're out there putting up numbers, who's gonna argue with you? No, the one thing I love too is, and I literally was just talking about this today, how you said your former coach never looked at it as a transaction. It was more like an actual relationship and relational. Like, I was joking with somebody and I said, yeah, that's what you got to do. Now, I was talking with somebody who was a Division I coach. I'm a Division III coach. So from that perspective, yes, we have different perspectives on recruiting. But like, for me, it's more relational for recruiting. Division III kids, they're paying to come to us. So I have to have that relationship, how you're talking. But then they were like, that's not how it is for me. And I'm like, yeah, because you have the money involved with it now. Like, it's a completely different dynamic, not even necessarily from divisions, but I'm getting more from what it used to be to what it is now. Like, it's all more money and financially, what can you do for me and why should I come to your program rather than, hey, I want this kid. Like, we want you, the coach coming to him at this point.
Yeah. If it gets down to, and this is the problem with NIL, right? And we're involved in this all the time with the kids that we are developing. They're talking about the money that they can make. And I'm like, yeah, but what about the enjoyment What about the relationships you're going to build? What about the experiences that you're going to get and your own development? It's not all about the money. The money will come, right? And again, I look back at those scenarios, and for coaching recruitment, if you've got incredible relationships with your athletes, then you can go and talk to them. That's your best recruitment, right? If your athlete cohort are going to say, best coach I've ever played for really cares about me and things are competitive and we're really good. If the kid wants to chase money, then you know he's not the right kid for your program. And I know it's hard, particularly at Division III level, it's hard. It's really hard to recruit because they're paying to be there. But if they're going to pay to be there and they're committed to the program, you got the right kid.
Yeah, no doubt.
So you mentioned too, I want to ask, because it sounded like, I believe it was Coach Dunlap, I believe you mentioned, was the one who kind of instilled discipline and was more like trying to push you to be more of a leader, it sounded like. Talk about how he did that, because that's one thing, especially nowadays, like maybe a coach has more of a stand back kid who doesn't really want to be more vocal or a vocal leader. They have more of a guy who goes out there and drops 20 a game and then it does it. Was more of a leader by actually doing it. But talk about, like, how did Coach Dunlap instill those qualities into you to become a leader? Because I know eventually, like, you went on to have your career. I know you became the grand final MVP. You brought your guys' team to an NBL. I keep wanting to say NBA, I swear. NBL championship. You know what? We'll give you an NBA championship if you want it, okay? Yeah. But still, like, what were some of those ways that he instilled those qualities into you as a player?
I think, first off, he role modeled it. So he was a grinder and worked tirelessly for the team and for us individually and collectively. The other thing was, it wasn't just me. He demanded it from everyone that was going to be a part of the program. So I walked in, it was already set that way. I didn't experience anything else other than the athletes demanding it of themselves and of each other. And then in the one-on-one conversations, he was really disciplined. Like, it was really tough for me to swallow that pill a couple of times. Because I walked over, I thought I was going to be Michael Jordan in that group. I had no idea. I didn't know what college basketball was about at all. I knew nothing about it. And I walked in there and just thought, I'm going to dominate this thing. And it was a really bitter pill for me to swallow. But he had honest conversations with me. So the relationship that we had straight away built on honesty, respect, and then the excellence just demanded the standard. And when it wasn't there, you call it out, make sure, and you're accountable for it. So he taught me how to be a man, right? To be honest to myself, treat people with respect, be disciplined. If I'm going to apply myself, apply yourself and be real about it, not superficial. And this is what we're talking about before, Mage, like the relationships that I've got with some of those guys on that team from 1993.
Exactly.
Are still some of the closest dudes in my life, right?
No doubt.
Because of that, everyone was on the same kind of page. So holding me accountable, but giving me the responsibility to be able to do that and then demanding it across the group individually and collectively, built on honesty, and it was already built. The culture was already there. It was just an expectation from the other athletes that if you're going to be part of this, this is the level you got to be at.
Was there a coach who changed how you saw things, especially like after it was over with, once you got done, especially now being on more of the coaching and then more of the operational leadership side of things? Was there anybody who really changed the way you viewed the game throughout your career?
Yeah. So there's a couple of players in that mix, but the coach is Brian Gorgian. So I came back and played professionally, and again, same kind of thing, right? So I had limited time in college, came back and signed a professional career contract and started playing. I thought I was going to dominate the league and all this sort of thing. I sat on the bench for 3 years, didn't play. I was training against, we had Australian guys, Australian team representatives on the team that I was playing for. And I thought I was going to jump in front of these guys, and they were really freaking good, like really good. And that was a whole nother lesson for me was, hey, you're only just starting your journey and the work never stops. Gorge really taught me, Dunlap taught me how to be a pro and how to approach things professionally and the standards that was going to be required. And then when I got to the pro ranks, it was learning that it never stops. You have to do the grind. And even when I was like 30, into my 30s, realizing that there's an 18-year-old here who's really bloody good. Like, you have to keep your axe to the grind. You got to stay sharp, right? So that's probably the biggest lesson I learned from Gorge was the work. And I loved it. I loved the work. And I was tireless at it. And it helped progress me, but it took me a few years. And it was a really tough conversation. I remember after 3 years, I was just training every day. I was in the gym a lot, had to transform my body and just get a lot stronger for my position and develop a skill set that could translate into professional basketball. I needed to get better at shooting. Yeah, I was a pretty good defender. I was a pretty athletic, but I needed to have something to hang my hat on so I could, that it would give me minutes on the court. And it was defensive capabilities, right? I'm long, 6'5" and long. But so I really worked on that hard. But after 3 years, I wasn't playing. I was doing my apprenticeship essentially. And then I sat down with Gore just at the end of that season. And I said, I'm done. Like I'm not making a lot of money. I'm probably going to go back to school and finish my degree because I didn't finish it. So I'm actually thinking about walking away from basketball. And he said to me, do you trust me? And I said, I think so. So, but it hasn't really worked out so far. Exactly. And he goes, if you trust me, sign another contract. Your career is about to take off. And I go, I'm not sure. And he goes, you need to trust me now. Sign another contract. Give me 2 years. And in the next 2 years, your career is going to get to the next level. And it did. I trusted him. The next year, like my apprenticeship was served and it enabled me then to compete at another level and I could dominate in my league and then got international opportunities off the back of that, Olympic Games and World Cups and the like. But I had to go through that process, which was really hard, like 3 years, man. It was really hard. I had to really eat a lot of humble pie, check the ego at the door and really recalibrate my life on, do I really want to do this? This is really hard and I'm not getting the rewards immediately. That delayed gratification thing, which is now forgotten about, is it was really hard. And that's why people don't want to do it, because it's hard. And I'm fortunate that it worked out. And I did trust him. And for that, I'll forever be grateful for him, because it really was the foundation building blocks that I needed in order to catapult into the next stage of my journey.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Let me ask you this, Smitty, and I don't even know if I've ever asked you this. When you finished playing, did you... One, it's a two-part question. One, did you ever consider coaching, like jumping into it full-time, full blast as a career? And then what led to the shift of joining the Boomers, and what inspired you to want to do what you're doing now? Because this is how many years now? You're well in the double figures. You've been doing this. How many years?
I don't even know, man. Like, it's been a while, but...
I lost track too. But
yeah, I've been in basketball for 35 years. Boomers, no, but international stuff. I've only been with the Boomers like 2020. So 5 years.
Okay, five. Yeah. I thought whatever reason was longer than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So jump into that question a little bit in terms of, did coaching cross your mind? And if it did, or if it didn't, then how did you change lanes to get to what you're doing now?
Yeah, it did. As soon as I finished playing, my kids were at primary school age or elementary school age. So I started coaching them and just helping out in the junior ranks to stay involved. But after my professional career finished, I was really bitter at sport. Like, I got let down a lot. The last two years of my professional life, like, I lost a lot. Both clubs went bankrupt. I didn't get paid for 2 years. So I lost my house. I just needed to get capital, so I had to sell some assets. And so I lost a bit through the last couple of years. So I got a little bit bitter at the sport, to be honest. And I had a shoulder reconstruction my last year, and it was really difficult, really painful. Kept me out of the Olympic Games, and I was going to be captain of that Games, and it was going to be my third. So I just got sour to the elite level and just left it alone. And I didn't actually get involved in elite-level basketball 15 years. I went corporate life. And just coached juniors at a good clip, like the high-end junior space, and was doing a lot to help kids get to the US and what have you. But always had that drawback. I've got a skill set that's not being utilized. That's a unique skill set because of the experience. And then when I got more mature and thought about my experience my last couple of years as a pro, like it happens, right? It didn't just happen to me, it happened to a few people. So I got over that. It took a while to get over it.
Yep.
But I got over it. And then I was looking for opportunities to get back involved in elite sport, high performance. And actually the thing that helped me the most is my corporate background. So understanding business, understanding how to manage people, how to manage a P&L, keeping people accountable, difficult conversations, that type of stuff, marketing, sales, product development, the whole bit. So I worked in banking and finance. Then I worked in software, managed a distribution company. So all that experience led me back to having a skill set to be an operational manager for the national team because my basketball background equipped me to understand how to be empathetic 100%. To athletes and coaches and have those conversations. And I had credibility immediately, so I didn't have to build credibility. So it was a good fit, and I understand why they recruited me for it. I did it part-time for the 2020 Olympics, which moved into through COVID, moved to 2021, and built the campaign out for the Boomers. And then that worked, and we won a medal. And then they offered me full-time position after that, and I've just grown from there. So now I manage all the national teams. So I've got 22 national teams underneath me. And yeah, I've got a specific interest in the Boomers. So I still take a little bit of more of an operational role with the men's senior team, but I'll be moving out of that soon, unfortunately, but I need to hire some more staff. But yeah, I've been really fortunate, man. Like it was 15 years away from the sport at an elite level, which was way too long, but it allowed me and equipped me to do what I do now really well, I think. So I've got a unique kind of perspective that and skill set that enables me to be effective in this space.
No question.
I love how you talked about the corporate background too, because that truthfully, and that we talk about how skills are transferable amongst industries. And in that in particular, like I'll say, I had started out my first job out of college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Got into sales, learned a little bit about that. I was working for the corporate business of Staples. So if you can sell office supplies to people when nobody wants to talk to you, it's hard to do. And then I got into the recruiting side, like recruiting actual people into accounting positions and finance positions. And right there, like to your point, having the corporate side, learning the recruiting, but then also learning the sales side, like that actually, if anything, helped me more, I think, with my coaching side, because now I can understand how to sell a program to somebody, especially not paper supplies that nobody wants to talk about. But no, my point is like, that those skills are definitely transferable. I'm glad you said that, because that the whole corporate side, you can always get into coaching from that or vice versa.
Yeah, for me, I remember when I was getting recruited from sport, I just put my resume out to a few different industries and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no idea. I did my master's when I was playing. In my last 5 years, I went and completed my master's. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I didn't want to work in basketball. Again, I was burnt by it and burnt out. But the skills I'd learned from sport were incredibly desirable in the corporate world. Everyone wanted leadership. Everyone wanted hard work ethic, a team, that being able to work within a team, holding people accountable, being responsible, being reliable, all that type of stuff that sport equips you with. And those skill sets were incredibly desirable in the marketplace. I didn't think about the other way until it was presented, saying, oh, your basketball background is great, but we really like the fact you've been able to manage people, manage teams, you know how to be your way around corporate finances, marketing, sales, product development. So those skills are what we would prefer to have in the basketball environment from an operations and management perspective or administrative perspective. Yeah, I have these conversations all the time with athletes going, how did you get? And I go, you have to go outside the sport. The sport actually probably won't give you the skills necessary to do this job really well. You can do it, but it's hard. Like you're better off going, learning and doing the grind in another environment, and then bringing those skill sets back into the sport where we welcome you. But yeah, it's an interesting journey, right?
Yeah, no doubt, man. Let me ask you this. If I'm an American coach and I want to go about building relationships with people in Australia for various reasons. It could be just to expand their network. It could be for potential recruiting opportunities, maybe getting into the NBL space. And what advice would you give to someone in the States that wanted to step into the Australian space? Because like you guys, honestly, like I know maybe France and Serbia and some of the other countries get a little bit more attention, but you guys have been underappreciated, I think, internationally, in my opinion. I don't know if I'm right or wrong about that, but like the level of basketball and the quality of that's being taught is what I mean. Just from the younger levels all the way up through the NBL, I think it's fantastic. And I don't think it gets talked about enough. And I would encourage American coaches to jump into your space more and tap into it more. So how would you advise somebody that wanted to do that, depending on those areas that I mentioned?
Yeah, I'll probably go back. I think to understand the system here is important, right? So our junior system is the envy of the world. It really is. It's crazy how good it is. Per capita, we're punching out way above our weight as far as international opportunity. And we've got a bunch of guys that play here that could play in the NBA but don't through life exposure, whatever it is, right? And we've got a high representation of athletes outside of the US playing in the US, so one of the highest percentages, right? So you're right, we punch really high above our weight. We've been very consistent in that on the men's and women's side now for a long time. And it's on the backbone of the junior system is really good. So to have an understanding of what that looks like is beneficial. To be honest, Mage, like most Aussies are good people, right? We want to associate with good people. Like, I would encourage any coach, if you know an Australian within the system and you reach out to them, they're going to want to help you. That's the way we're built. Like, I don't know, Mage, if you said to me, hey, I've got this coach that wants to connect with Gorge, can you do an intro? Yeah, man, you're my guy. If you trust this guy, he's in, no problem. So we're really trusting, we're good people. We want to build on our own networks and relationships, and we look at the US as a really good market for us to be able to do that, not only for the benefit of coaches over there, but for our benefit to learn new things and expand our own. But yeah, Major, I'd just say it, like, find someone who knows someone and get an introduction. That person's not going to say no, they're going to say yes. So yeah, what do you need? How can I help? I think we're generous with our culture regardless. And if we can help someone improve or get better or provide an experience, we're going to do it. And you'll see there's a lot of American coaches over here, a lot. At every level, there's a lot. We value what the US does from a coaching perspective. Their pathway is really set and solid, where ours gets bottlenecked real quick because we don't have as many professional teams and leagues and what have you, right? We don't have the college system, so we don't have the money to provide a professional system like the US does. I know your scale's a lot bigger as far as population, what have you, but we get real pointy real quick. So there's only 10 professional jobs in the National League. Then maybe I hire 6 professional coaches in my national programs, the rest are part-time. So there's not a lot of full-time professional gigs here, but we do it really well.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad you said that.
I would say the only thing to note if you're going to Australia, and I said it once before we hopped on here, is just watch out for those spiders, because those things, I'm telling you, that is the number one thing on my list. Like, there's two, three places that I could visit: Greece, Italy, and then Australia would be in the top three. But then after seeing all those, I don't know. I'd love to come visit you sometime, Coach Smith. I would.
We got anything that can kill you is here. So you got octopus, spiders, snakes, crocodiles. We're a dangerous mob down here, man. You got to be careful.
Kangaroo will run you over too if you're not careful.
Kangaroos will mess you around, man. They'll mess you up. They will mess you up. So you got to be careful. But that's what I'm saying. Just reach out. We'll put you under our wing. You'll be safe with us and no problem.
Yes, sir. So I want to ask you a little bit about the national team side of things. Being the director of basketball operations, working more on the operational side, as you said, I know you have a strong background prior to being a senior partner, being with Commonwealth Bank. So you obviously had a lot of more of the financial side of work. But talk about just the director of basketball operations side. I know a lot of people might know that role from a college perspective, but from a national team perspective, is that any different? Is there any more duties that you have? Like, how does that look?
Yeah, it's really different. So we look at things in cycles, right? So Olympic cycles. So we get a lot of our funding from government if you're an Olympic sport. So you get funding via government, as well as player levies come up and they fund more the participation side. So we govern the entire participation side in the country. So we're a far-reaching organization, but we're relatively small. So on the national team side, so for me, an operational is I'm building their campaign for 4 years. So it's a 4-year cycle, and that's the way I look at it. So I'm looking at what do we need in order to podium finish at the next Olympic Games. So let's use LA, because I'm looking at the LA cycle now. So as soon as we finished in Paris, the girls win bronze, the men finish fifth. Okay, how do I finish higher? the men's and women. We start from day dot. All right, let's look at the athletes. So has that landscape changed in international basketball? So in the men's, it's changed significantly over the last 10, 20 years, is that every position's gone probably 4 or 5 inches taller and longer. So in order for us to compete at the next level, we need longer and bigger athletes. And the women are the same. So we've got to be able to shoot the ball better. So we know that we've got to start developing at a younger age some of these skill sets. So that's what translates downhill and integrates into our junior programs. But for me, it's, all right, so what else do we need to do in order to finish in LA and win a medal? I need more international experience for some of these players. So now I've got to build campaigns out over the next 4 years going and within tight windows of opportunity, because all our athletes are playing professionally in the NBA or WNBA or the NBL here or the WNBL. So where are our windows? Who do we want to play and why? Is it going to help us get better or not? Is it a relationship that I need to keep strong? Do I need to set up an MOU or a memorandum of understanding so we've got an ongoing relationship and that it's of a value exchange that's equal or a win-win? So there are all kinds of things. Then I've got to think about the commercial aspects. So how am I going to fund this? Then I've got to talk to the finance team and the marketing team. Okay, these are the opportunities that I think we want to do. Can we monetize any of this? What sponsorship are you looking at? I need $750,000 in order to deliver these two activities or events that we want to do. And then I work with the coaches and I say, does this satisfy what you want to do in order to win a medal in LA? And then I get into the real operational side of and of the detail of what's it going to cost me and what budget do I need in order to deliver this. And then I talk to finance and then we start executing. And then I deliver it down to the layer beneath me, the team management, and then they deliver it. So there's a lot of work goes into thinking about what do you need to do in order to medal. Right. So we don't mess around down here. And it doesn't always work out. There's a lot of variables that come into play. But we've got a very clear plan over that next four-year period. And sometimes for us, it's I've got 2032 in mind as well because it's in Brisbane, it's in the home soil. So everything I do now is not only LA, it's for 32. So I've got 15, 16-year-old kids I'm identifying right now that we're investing in and coaches to get them on their pathway because I see them playing for us in 2032. So it's a big project when you think about it. And when you get into the minutia, the detail is out of control. And to deliver it, it's really resource intensive, right? So it's really difficult to deliver on that. But I really like the strategic stuff. I love talking to coaches around, how do you think we're going to do this, right? What do we need in order to win? What type of athlete do you need? What skill sets do we need to improve on? How are we going to drive that? How are we going to deliver a 12% increase in shooting percentages across the board? How are we going to do that? So we get into training plans and I listen to them talk about how they're going to do that from an expectation from the athletes and deliver that across the board. It's really cool. And I understand that stuff because I was there. So when they talk crap, I call them out on it.
Exactly.
I go, no, that's not going to work. You need to say, be specific. How are you going to, so every training practice, you're going to have 15 minutes of competitive shooting or whatever it is, right? So that's my role. It's a little bit morphed into something a little bit more than just operational, but I love sitting up here and I'm really helping. I feel like I'm really providing a contribution that we'll see for the next 10, 15 years, and then I'll pass it on to someone else and they'll take it to the next level. But I'm really fortunate. I've got the trust of my coaches. I've played with a few of the athletes still that are on the last few years of their career. So there's a relationship, strong relationship with the playing group. So I'm in a really fortunate position at the moment with my senior men and senior women's team. And then my other two teams that I'm really passionate about are the wheelchair men and wheelchair women's team that play at the Paralympics. I knew nothing about wheelchair basketball and my eyes have been completely open to really value these athletes. They're insane. They are so bloody good. The complications and even the coaches, how they coach, the tactics and technical requirement to coach wheelchair is insane. Like able body or 5-on-5, the running game is simple, like in comparison. The difficulties and complexities that you've got to face with a wheelchair program, and the athletes are incredible. Like you think about, I talk about these NBA athletes and they go, oh, I had this really tough season. I go and talk to the guy in the wheelchair and tell me about your adversity.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? No doubt.
So across the board, I'm engaged with a lot of groups and a lot of teams, but I'm really enjoying it. And the playing background and coaching background has really helped me to deliver on some of this stuff. It's given me a nice perspective that I think adds value with these programs.
Oh, it absolutely does, man. I'm proud of you, brother. That's called, as Jobs used to say, maybe not quite putting a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs used to say, but that's close in terms of putting a dent in a country and a program. And that's some long lasting stuff. It's funny, when I was at Charlotte, we did a community service thing and we had a local wheelchair team come to our gym and just talk about what they do, their league and how they train. And then some of them let five of our guys played 5-on-5 against five of their guys and literally got destroyed. Yeah. We had guys falling over. They ended up on one wheel trying to turn. They had no control. But it was just to create some empathy in the gym. Like, fellas, you get to run around at will. Like, you literally get to run around at will. And how about the heart that these guys have? They love the game that much, knowing that they can't play it like you. And they love it anyway.
Yeah.
And so it was one of the coolest experiences that we ever had. And our guys, they were like, wow, man, these dudes are freaking heroes. Oh, it's unbelievable.
We got a guy, and we're really fortunate. We've got a young guy by the name of Jaylen Brown. He'll be the best wheelchair player in the world in 2 years. He's 18 or 19, right? He's ridiculous. The athleticism, the length, like his maneuverability, agility in a chair, he's insane. Like, I went to Paris and watched him play. I was there as my operational support, but I hadn't seen him play before and blew my mind. Right? Blew my mind. And, you know, and the funny thing is, he has no idea, right?
He's playing.
He's no ego, right? Yeah. He just comes in and does his job. And he's so exciting to watch. Like, when people come, they've never seen wheelchair basketball before, they go, who's that guy? Yeah. And the beauty is he's got no idea. He's got no ego. He doesn't get paid to play. He just does it because he absolutely loves it and passionate about it. And you see it on the court, right? Like, it's amazing. So, that whole experience dealing with our wheelchair athletes has really provided me a total different lens on the way I see things. And I've been really fortunate to be incorporated in that program or those programs and be opened to just be welcomed into that environment, learning as much as I can and trying to influence it as much as I can as well. But it's really given me a lot of positives that I can take into the business and share across a broader group. So yeah, it's been awesome.
They're incredible, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that whole thing, I took two things. One, obviously you don't take anything for granted. Anybody who has the opportunity to be able to play, sometimes let's be honest with ourselves. We've all, I'm sure, had a situation where you're like, you really take something for granted. And then you see some perspective and you're like, wow, okay. Yeah. Open up your mind a little bit. But to that, like going back to what we were talking about, orchestrating, you were orchestrating a whole nation, which is the most, just to think about that. Like when in the beginning you said you run 22 teams, right? Or help organize and manage 22 teams. That alone is mind blowing. But then you say out of those 22 teams, you're orchestrating a whole nation. And it irritates me respectfully. It has nothing to do with you because of the states. The way we do things, we go and find some guy off the street that says, hey, you want to be our AAU coach and teach our youth? And then instead, you guys are orchestrating the whole nation to be able to run a program around the professional levels and then the Olympic levels.
I wouldn't say I run the whole nation. So after Paris, right, so we know we've got Brisbane coming up, right? So we really need to perform well in 8 years' time. Now it's 7 years, right? So the clock is ticking. So there's a requirement and an obligation to ensure we're doing everything we can, because after Sydney, the Sydney Olympics in 2000, the burst of pride that we had in our country, right, that we benefited from 20 years, right? So it's a cultural shift that we know that we can have an impact. It's massive, right? So I don't take that lightly. Right, so I look at that and go, we've got an opportunity here to have a significant impact on the country just by our performances of playing basketball. So look at that and go, okay, now if we're going to get serious about this, is a sophisticated approach. It's like a consulting exercise to figure out what do we need to do in order to get the best outcome, and we need to make the investment now. So we haven't got time to wait. You know, let's make the investment now, build a plan, build a strategy. And if everyone agrees, we start executing. And I'm really fortunate that, again, go back to the original point we first started talking about, our junior system is awesome. Right? So the talent is bubbling through all the time. Right. So I capture them at 18, essentially, or 16, depending on how good the kids are. Once they're identified, now we're putting them into a program that we know that if they stay with it and we pick the right individuals, they're going to be pros. We know we're really good at that. We're really good at turning very good athletes into very good basketball players and pros. And once they're in their pro environment, like in the NBA or the WNBA, then our job's done, and now the polish is going to happen elsewhere. So we've got a finite time to find that identification of talent and the physiological requirement and the basketball requirement and the psychological requirement. Once we can measure that and find out exactly who we want, we invest in it, the outcome's going to happen because our system is that good. So I don't take, that's not me. I do not take any credit for that at all. I'm just able to provide a little bit of influence on what we do within that journey of those athletes. And hopefully in 28 and 32, you see an outcome that is the result of that, and I've benefited it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Explain this, because I think people listening, and again, for various reasons, coaches may want to know. It could be for just relationally, could be for recruiting purposes, but like obviously, when kids are identified around that 16, 18, that's what you would call like the center. Does it go Center of Excellence, Institute, and then potential academy, and then put as maybe pro prospect? Is that kind of the track, or explain how that goes from like a 16?
Yeah, 17 it's even simpler than that. So the states and territories, right? So they have their own state development programs that they pick their best kids, right, to participate in. So depending on how big the state is and how big the cohort of athletes that they've got, like the state I live in, you know, there's probably a million kids playing basketball. So there's probably, they select 200 kids, right, across that cohort that they invest in to start to do some high performance introductions. So it's physically weights and strength and conditioning, essentially, that support them in their basketball and start to specialize in basketball on skill sets. So they've got ex players and coaches, elite coaches that come in and deliver training sessions and development sessions. That's outside of their team scenarios. So this is just individual stuff, right? So each kid goes through that. So by the time they reach 16, the elite of those state development kids, so we might have the top 50 in the country, we invite to a camp in Canberra where our COE program is, a center of excellence. And out of that 50, we select 12 men and 12 women to live on campus and look like a college program academy, essentially. But they live at the Australian Institute of Sport. And we have on the women's side and the men's side, two of our best junior development coaches in the country. Are living there, they're training the kids every single day, they're developing the framework that we spoke about. So what are the physiological requirements that we need a kid to look like to play international level? What are the basketball skill sets they need? And what is the psychological makeup they require in order to be competitive at the next level? That's what we develop. So we have them from 16 to 18, and by the time they graduate their high school years, then we release them into either professional ranks or typically to the US NCAAs. But they're the best kids in the country, and they all go to, I don't know, Gonzaga and Duke and Pitt and Penn State and whatever. So we get them to a level where they're very good basketballers, and we know they're able to compete at the next level. Some go to college, some go to pro, some go to Europe. And we just have a constant conveyor belt. And then every year, like we just had four kids drafted. All of them went to the center of excellence, right? So it's a conveyor belt. We know if we're selecting the right kid, we know that we deliver on the basketball side. They'll come out a very good basketballer and hopefully a better person from the experience. And then they're going into the next chapter of their journey, which is typically the NCAA and the pro leagues.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw the Tui kid actually at the combine. He played really well.
He's a special kid, 6'10" wing. He's multi-talented.
Yeah.
Probably needs to refine a skill that he can be like really good at, because he's really good at everything.
Signature thing.
Yeah. What is his, what can he hang his hat on? Because he's really good.
Yeah.
Rocco Zakarski, Tyrese Proctor. The other kid who got drafted, Lachlan Albrecht, went to UC Riverside. No one really knew about him. Came back to Australia. We kind of highlighted him. We had his agent talking to us, and I had a look at him. I go, that kid's really good. So we brought him into our fold and have helped him along the journey. But a late developer, kind of like myself, right? Late developer, and then has just been drafted. So, yeah, it's, yeah, we get to influence a lot. And a lot of these kids that are going through now, and we spoke a little bit around the NIL stuff, we're getting, it's out of control. The center of excellence kids that we get, if we could just take a percentage of the money some of these kids are earning going into college now, it's out of control. It is insane. If I'm a college coach too, if you don't have a relationship with us at that program, you're crazy. Like
that's precisely why I asked this question.
Like, I'm telling we've proven it over 40 years. We've had that program. We have proven it. We know what we're doing. We know who we're selecting. We know that we produce on the men and women. Women are even better. It's out of control. We've had 3 number one draft picks, I think 14 top 10s. It's out of control, the amount of talent that's coming out of that program.
No, that's remarkable.
I'm glad you explained that. I mean, like, if I'm a coach that is in ability to recruit right now and have the, obviously, got to have the budget and the means and do some things internationally. But you guys, if you guys aren't at the top of the list, that somebody's out of their minds, because you're right. It's too much quality quality and longevity.
Yeah. And the benefit for us too is that we've had 2 years with that kid, sometimes 3 years, depending on how early we get them. But now we help them determine the best program for them, because it's not always about the money. We're trying to tell them the money will come. So don't, the money's the byproduct.
The right kind.
You need to keep doing that. We think you're an international 4. Don't go to a program that's going to chuck you coming off the bench as a 5.
Yep.
Right. You need to be a 3. Don't, just because you're 6'8", don't go to a smaller program or a smaller conference and be a 4 or a 5. Like, you're a 3. So we've got design on what you need to be and what you will be to maximize who you can be as a basketball player. And we've got influence on that. So that when programs come through all the time, college programs, and we'll talk to them around, what's your development plan for this kid? All right, we don't agree. We agree. So that's how we see, that's what we've been building. That's where we see the biggest value for this athlete. So we're in a trusted position of confidence with these kids as well. Yeah, it's a good position to be in, but it's a relationship, right? Like, it's built over time, and they trust the coaches, they trust the environment, and they trust the program. But, and it goes back to our first point, those coaches really care about those kids too. Like, they're selecting them, they spend daily with them, like day in, day out.
The kids here are getting texts from those coaches at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, hey, man, watch you play. Sure. They know the kid is asleep, but hey, man, watch you play. That was awesome. Or, hey, don't worry about it. Hang in there. Keep shooting the ball. Next one's in. But whatever that looks like, I'm sure those kids, that connection, just because they leave and come over here, that connection stays strong.
Without a doubt. And when they come back, it's funny because I still get, you know, you still get Patty Mills and Joe Ingles and stuff. They still go back to Canberra, where the Center of Excellence is located. And they're just gravitated to it because they really enjoyed their experience there. Andrew Bogut, Lauren Jackson, Penny Taylor, there's a bunch have come through there that they gravitate to that program because the memories that they've got were so tight.
Yeah. You hear a lot of the French guys saying that about NCEP. The same thing.
Same.
A ton same. Of those guys.
Very similar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got a bigger scale, right? They've got multiple campuses, but yeah, they've got a very similar program. And actually, we converse with France all the time. So I'm my equivalent in France, great guy. We're constantly talking, and we're not protective of our IP. Anyone wants to come in and see what we do, No problem. We're happy to share. There's no real IP on it because we're not rocket science as far as what we're delivering on the court, right? So I'm sure everyone's delivering something similar. We want the world of basketball to continue. We want to know what the innovation is and what's working well over there. And if we're doing something well, we want to be able to share it because I want to be able to borrow something from China and Serbia and the like. But the international federations are pretty good. We don't mess around. We're happy to support each other and try and grow the game.
If anybody out there wants to take an international trip, please hit me up. We'll go take a trip over to Australia. We have Coach Smith's word that he's going to protect us from the spiders and the kangaroos. So that being said, we can definitely take a trip out there, Mage, if you're interested. But
He and I have been talking about it. We just haven't been able to coordinate it yet because he's got a million things going on. But trust me, we've been having some conversations and I'm still trying to figure out how to do it. So I don't know. I'm not giving up, but I don't know what that looked like. But
We actually just finished our coach conference.
Yeah, you were texting me about that. Yeah.
So I got to get you out, man, for that. So I'm going to come over next month, man. We'll hang out and
we'll coordinate something.
Yeah.
Oh, I would love it. That'd be a blast.
Coach Smith, honestly, overall, like, I know we tell everybody, but just giving us the time of day, being able to talk with us, especially you're running a country over there in 22 teams.
Australian oligarch over there.
That's right.
You have more than enough on your plate. But in all seriousness, thank you very much. We really do genuinely like hearing your stories prior to. I know Mage was talking highly about you. Just hearing everything you're doing, of course, I see why. But just going from your playing career to being what you're doing now, and it's a great story to be told. And that being said, it's great for people to learn about that too, especially this side of things if they want to get an international. So thank you for giving us the time of day and chatting with us.
Pleasure. Appreciate it. Thanks, guys. And to connect with my man, Mage, anytime. Appreciate it.
Smitty, listen, before Dougie lands the plane, had a blast coaching you. I look at that picture probably a couple times a month. Amazing memories. You are a hell of a player. I think you shocked a few of the guys when you got here about how athletic you were. And you posterized a few dudes and coming to America type deal. But more importantly, to see the man you become, the husband you become, the dad you become, executive, put that down the list. Man, husband, father, those top three. Unbelievably proud of you, brother. Not the least bit shocked. Not the least bit shocked. And love you to death, man. Can't wait to see you again. And this one's been special for me personally. So thank you again for doing it, brother.
Anytime, Major. You impacted my life at a really precious moment of my history, right? So I really valued it, and you've always been there, man. Anything you ever need, man, no problem.
Likewise, man, always.
Well, Coach, thank you. And for everybody out there, thank you for tuning in, listening to Coach Smith. And for that, does another episode of the Rising Coaches podcast. Again, Alan Major, Doug Caputo. All you coaches out there, talk to you soon. Keep working and keep rising, coaches.
Help your players get more out of their training sessions with our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. As the official shooting machine of Rising Coaches and the number one selling shooting machine in the world, Dr. Dish provides an experience packed with more reps, more motivation, and just plain out more fun. Be sure to mention Rising Coaches for an additional $250 off select Dr. Dish shooting machines.
I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together. We'll